Because of listeners like you, Preborn has helped to rescue over 67,000 babies. Your $28 to sponsor one ultrasound doubled a baby's chance at life. Your tax-deductible gift saves lives. Please join us in this mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. It is Thursday, July 31st. So happy last day of July. And in a week that has been marked by a lot of very bizarre violence, this headline from yesterday, GOP lawmaker was set on fire in a targeted attack. This coming from Trending Politics. A Virginia lawmaker has been airlifted to a medical facility after he was set on fire in a targeted attack, according to a statement from the Danville Police Department. On Wednesday around 11:30 a.m., officers said they were dispatched to the 700 block of Main Street for a report of a male being set on fire. The life-saving crew responded to the scene. Officials said that the victim, who has been identified as a Danville City Councilman, was airlifted to a local medical facility. The extent of his injuries is currently, as of this article, unknown, and as of that report. So according to witnesses, the suspect forcefully entered the victim's place of work at Showcase Magazine. After the confrontation, the attacker doused the lawmaker with a flammable liquid, at which point the councilman attempted to flee. The attacker then ran him down and set him on fire, witnesses said. So more is coming out now about this, and according to some reports and also social media posts, apparently the attacker and the victim were known to each other. This was more of a personal confrontation rather than anything to do with the victim's official lawmaking duties. Nothing, according to this report, about his councilman or, you know, official capacity. But the question remains. I mean, this type of violence is just continuing to be over and over and over in headlines. And there's something to be said about the state of the world, and particularly the state of America, when more of these headlines just become consistently routine. I mean, it's like we can't go a day without hearing about some type of violence. And what is this saying about our culture and especially the next generation? Well, let's welcome in Ryan Helfenbein, who is the Vice President of Communications at Liberty University and the Executive Director of the Standing for Freedom Center. And Ryan, I know you were there in Virginia, so have heard about this particular headline. So I want to get your thoughts on the story itself and then, you know, kind of what this generally says about the trajectory of our culture.
Yeah, Jenna, it was shocking yesterday. I'm actually just about 60 miles north of Danville here in Lynchburg. And so it's not that far from here. And there are many folks actually in the Lynchburg area that know of somebody that lives down in the Danville area. And so we're hearing a lot of reports and stories about what this might be. And I think the initial thing, I totally agree with you, that we're seeing a level of depravity in our country, an exhibition of violence. You think about what just happened just a couple of months ago in Minnesota, where lawmakers were targeted and assassinated by somebody associated with Governor Tim Walz. It's one of those things where I think the more immediate that sort of jumps into our mind is, is this another instance in which somebody is perpetrating violence, is trying to take, you know, innocent life for any kind of political purpose? And that was what immediately jumped into my mind. And then I saw, of course, that there might be some other things that are implicated in this incident, that it might be a personal dispute or a personal matter. In which case, again, gives no excuse for it, but it's a reminder, too, that in the world of politics, you know, these are human beings made in God's image. And we see sin, we see the fall of man, we see depravity being exhibited. They're normal people like we are. And oftentimes, whether it be Aaron Burr killing Alexander Hamilton, or whether it be somebody trying to, you know, assassinate the president of the United States, there are all kinds of people out there that who plot and want to carry out acts of destruction and violence. And certainly, we know where this all emanates from. And that is evil, that is corruption, that is sin, that is the fallenness of mankind, and that's why we need a savior. But yeah, these are the kinds of headlines, Jenna, that are shocking. But in the greater sense of understanding the context of the world that we live in, it's a good reminder that we need Christ, we need the gospel, we need salvation. This country is full of people who will commit acts of violence. It is only by the grace of God that it doesn't happen.
Yeah, so well said, Ryan. And you know, I appreciate that you bring up some of the history as well of some more notable acts of violence in even American history. And I wonder when you talk about the duel between Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr that ultimately resulted in Hamilton's death, and you know, you look at some of these other things throughout American history, do you think that this is just a continuation of the problem of sin and the perpetuation of evil, or has there been a heightened increase in a systematic disregard for the sanctity of human life? And while, you know, we can point to instances like that duel and say, well, you know, this wasn't particularly honorable that men used to settle disputes this way, but at least we could understand, you know, that that was a type of contest where it wasn't just seemingly a random act of violence, like somebody going in to a Midtown Manhattan building and just, you know, shooting the place up. I mean, so does it seem to you like the world view is becoming more and more evil, and we're seeing that in the culture today? Or how do you compare maybe the current state with the last, you know, 250 years or even just the last 50?
There is no doubt in my mind that the perpetuation of pornographic violence, some have referred to it as that, through social media, through video games, through just cinema and the arts. We're seeing more and more sort of nihilistic depictions of violence that come up, and then people who don't really have the inclination to turn away, you know, but we'll watch it and view it. There's no doubt that our culture has been desensitized to this violence, but good reminder is going all the way back to Genesis chapter 4, when Cain killed his brother Abel. Violence has been among us from the very beginning. And it's one of those things where just as God called out, you know, to Cain that the blood of his brother, you know, Abel, is crying out from the ground. You know, the earth was subjugated to a further curse as a result of Cain's shedding of innocent blood. We have to recognize as Christians in our worldview is that sin perpetuates this violence. This is the sin of hatred. This is, by the way, the original racism. Oftentimes people today, when they talk about racism, they only talk about it in terms of ethnicity and hatred and prejudice towards people of different. But actually, it started with sameness. It's the fact that the first murder was a brother killing another brother. And so, you know, I see some of these disputes as they arise. They are somewhat politically motivated. Others are crimes of passion, where, you know, a man is fighting another man because there's some kind of, you know, dispute over a love affair or a tryst or something like that. some are in the case of the Aaron Burr situation. This is a situation where this was a code of honor between gentlemen back then. And, of course, we would dispute whether that is a real gentlemanly way to settle a matter. It's not. But that's how they used to do it back in the old days. But there is no doubt that there is a perpetuation of violence. And then also through social media and the spreading of information, we just see more of it today. So, you know, the thing is that as soon as something happens, like a man dousing another man in gasoline and setting him on fire, the world knows about it almost instantaneously. And so when things like this used to happen 50 years ago, 100 years ago, and there were those types of things, serial killers have been around a long time, grotesque acts of violence have been around for a long time. We just know about it so much more quickly. It's not put in print. It's actually hitting our phones. And in that sort of digital, fourth industrial revolution, the digital technology is able to spread that information so quickly. I think that's part of the reason why we see it and it's so prevalent is because we can get that information instantaneously.
And I'm speaking with Ryan Helfenbein, who is the Vice President of Communications at Liberty University in Lynchburg, Virginia, and also the Executive Director of the Standing for Freedom Center. And we're talking about this headline that a GOP lawmaker there, locally a councilman in the state of Virginia, was set on fire in a targeted attack. And while this particular attack it reportedly was a personal dispute, nothing to do with his official office, we are seeing more and more targeted violence specifically against office holders as well. And in the United States, Ryan, the entire process and setup and makeup of government is not only a peaceful transition of power, but that we, the people, get to select and prefer our leaders. It's not supposed to be the type of violence, even that we see in the Old Testament, right? Of, you know, kings being murdered for someone else to take over. And we saw all throughout the Middle Ages. And there's a reason why the mantra says, you know, uneasy is the head that wears the crown. And so we are supposed to be different here in America, and yet we have seen, especially in the last few years, more and more targeted attacks against lawmakers specifically. What does that tell you about the state of the culture in America?
Yeah, I definitely see a paradigm shift in our country. And I would say, you know, when you go back and you read the history of the old kings in Europe, especially back in the medieval era, you know, you had all kinds of incestuousness, you had all kinds of assassinations and killings, and certainly there were times in which if you were a monarch, you know, you had you were the head of a kingpin, you were the head of the country and the nation, but you had other people that were in hereditary title and in line, and they would find ways to kill you. And part of the whole reason, you go back to the ancient world, there were cupbearers to the king. Why? Because the cupbearer had to test the wine and make sure it was not poisoned, or that the food testers to taste that it wasn't poisoned. Why? Because ultimately the monarch, the king, had absolute power, and there were people who had a vested interest in having him killed. You know, the whole purpose of our republic, our democratic republic, is this succession of power, as you pointed out, and peaceful transition of power. And this is about the delegation of those powers by the will of the people. And these are representative heads of government, but the power is vested ultimately by the people. And for the longest time, America, as a Christian nation with a Christian ethos, moral ethos, and a Christian understanding of law and civics, we in our tradition have been able to relinquish power from one election to the next. And yet today, I think what we're seeing is more anarchy. We're seeing less and less respect for authority, which is ultimately not, you know, authority in terms of government authority. It's God's authority. There's less respect for God. Those who are in law enforcement, less respect for people made in God's image. And so there is clearly a pattern in which worldview plays into this. It plays into the violence. It plays into people not ultimately having respect for one another or respect for those who have been placed in government. And so, yeah, the United States has prided itself as a tradition, being a Christian, founded as a Christian nation, being a nation that has a Bill of Rights and enumerated powers and so on and so forth. You know this better than anyone. The will of the people, though, ultimately uphold it. And that's the thing. When you don't have enough people who are willing to act civilly, all panic and chaos breaks loose. And then you have something like what France underwent or the Bolsheviks in 1917. And you see a revolution in which everything is overthrown. That's the scary thing. We want to do everything we can to thwart that in the United States of America. And that's why we need law and order and civility. But most importantly, we need the gospel to get into people's hearts and their minds. That is what I think ultimately keeps people, it keeps and maintains public order and the peace, is not just the penalty of the law, but an understanding that there is a God that we all must ultimately give an account to for our lives.
Ryan Helfenbein, what a great word on this Thursday morning. Really appreciate that so much, because it is a reminder in the midst of a week that really has been full of a lot of very concerning and sobering headlines, that the solution is always a return back to the truth of the gospel of Christ, and that we need to reach a lost and fallen world with the truth, because that is our only hope. And hopefully that is the mission not only of each of us in our individual Christian life to share the truth of the gospel, but also the church's mission as well. So you can follow Ryan Helfenbein on X at @rhelfenbein, and also the Standing for Freedom Center. They do a lot of really great videos on the Christian worldview. And we'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, so in some good news, the latest National Religious Broadcasters, or NRB, and Barna Group study of 2025 shows that Christian media has an extremely broad reach overall as Christianity's cultural presence stabilizes. So this is really interesting data that reveals that Christian content is not only widely consumed, but also plays a formative role in shaping worldviews, deepening faith, and providing guidance in an increasingly chaotic culture. So this is really encouraging, especially for those of us here at the American Family Radio Network, because this is what we aim to do each and every day, is to shape worldviews, deepen faith, and provide guidance. So this is a really great study. And let's welcome in Troy Miller, who is the NRB president and CEO. Troy, so what else did this study tell us about Christian media's impact? And I think, like I said, this is just very encouraging.
It is encouraging, Jenna, and thanks for having me on today to discuss this. Look, we started this study with Barna back in the fall, and that's exactly what we wanted to figure out. What is the impact that Christian media is having today? And one of the things I think right off the bat that really caught us off guard, I think the number was higher than I expected it to be, was that 60% of Americans, that's general population, that's not just Christians, but 60% of the general population tunes into some form of Christian media on a regular basis. And that number is huge. I think you can almost not find any other genre out there that has that much support across this country.
That is really incredible. And that's encouraging as well, to know that it's not just Christians that we're reaching, of course, to deepen our faith that is already there, but we're also reaching those who perhaps haven't yet claimed Jesus as their Lord and Savior. And so there's an opportunity there for evangelism as well as ministry. And so this is the 60% of American adults that consume Christian media in some form. So whether that's TV, radio, podcasts, news websites, social media, or YouTube. And interestingly, this study also said that Gen Z leads the way with 64% of Gen Z engaging with Christian social media accounts, followed by millennials at 58%. There are a lot of studies, Troy, that are saying that Gen Zers are getting their news from social media. They're very much online. I read a study just the other day that said that the average Gen Zer spends about 9 hours on digital media in some form. Of course, that's entertainment and business. I mean, that's, you know, all together. But this highlights, I think, why Christians do need to be engaged in media and provide content that is coming from a biblically correct and faith-based worldview.
Absolutely, Jenna. I mean, that was another number I think most people would have, you know, thought stereotypically that Christian media was consumed by, you know, older generations, baby boomers, X-geners, but not. Those were the top two demographics, age demographics, that are consuming media. And it also, Jenna, says that if you're in Christian media, you have a real responsibility to be multi-generational. The Gen Zers, as you said, and the Gen Y, the millennials, they're looking and listening, which goes with our next piece of information, which I think is a real indication of the rejection of the cultural messages that are going out there. Was the number one reason that people were tuning into Christian media was to find hope and encouragement. And it tells you that the secular marketplace is full of so much despair, so much division, so much negativity, that these generations are looking for hope. They're looking for purpose in their lives. And that puts, as you said, a great responsibility on us as Christian communicators.
Yeah, so well said. And I'm speaking with Troy Miller, who is the CEO of the NRB, the National Religious Broadcasters. And you talked about the responsibility as well of Christian media to be multi-generational. And there's been some kind of talk back and forth of whether Christians should engage some types of social media content, like, for example, TikTok or X, or, you know, some of these platforms that maybe have, you know, some implicit dangers, you know, perhaps, but also that are filled with a lot of content that isn't Christian. And should we be engaging those platforms? And when you look at this, and these studies that show how much Gen Z is on these types of media, as you said, it's not just, you know, kind of the older generation that is watching cable news, which is frankly kind of dying off. There's actually an increase in the digital footprint among Gen Z. I think the answer to that is yes.
Oh, absolutely. Look, where else in this world, you know, do we find where we go into that's perfect light? That's not our call. Our call is to go to shine light in the darkness. And so if we just give up these platforms, these new emerging platforms to that darkness, then where are these young people going to find that hope? Let me tell you something I thought was really cool. I saw a story about 6 months ago about a young man who is a gamer, right? So he's on one of these game systems, and they get on and play these multiplayer gamers. Well, he decided that he was going to start a Bible study before they did their gaming, and that grew in. So on one of these Xboxes, that grew to a Bible study now that was over 200 people from around the world tune in before they play their games, and they're hearing the word of God. That's what it means to shine light in the darkness. And we need to do that in every medium possible.
Yeah, so well said. And I think that with such strong youth engagement via those types of platforms, Christian media organizations should adjust our approach in order to reach those digital natives more and more effectively, because the users are already there. So we just bring the content. And the study also found, Troy Miller, that 2/3 of the general population view Christian media as valuable and trustworthy, rising to 4 in 5 among active users, which I think is a really fascinating rationale for why people tune in to specifically Christian media, because people know that they're going to get their news and their content in a way that is trustworthy. It's valuable. It's credible. But there also will be a bias. And of course, like here at American Family Radio Network, of course we have a bias. We have a Christian worldview bias that we are going to talk and comment on stories from a specifically biblical worldview perspective. And that bias is in such contrast with the secular media. I think that's a good thing. And that's something that, well, you know, that because it's very open, I think that actually that type of bias lends to the credibility, value, and trustworthiness of Christian media over a lot of these other talking heads that you might see on secular networks where people are saying, okay, well, you know, your motivation is obviously something different, and it's also predicated on a false or a secular worldview. How does that play out into the broader media sphere of reaching people who aren't already Christians and wanting that perspective, but reaching the users that are there and saying, you know, you're listening to Christian content because it's trustworthy?
Right. And look, that's in a stark contrast to mainstream legacy media that would find their trustworthy ratings and approval ratings well down into the teens. And so it's the interesting thing, as you said here, is Christian media is providing really still two kind of roles. It's still providing the core role of discipling Christians. So it's a great place where Christians tune in to on a regular basis. But the fact that the culture at large, the fact that we go back to that 60% of Americans tune into some form of Christian media, and knowing that Christian media is biased, I mean, we don't hide it like the mainstream media tries to hide their bias. It's out there. It's you know, per se on our sleeves, and yet people are still tuning in because, again, they're looking for that hope. They're looking for a message that is different from what they're hearing in the mainstream. And Jenna, the second highest reason that people turned in, and I thought this was really another sort of indicator of a rejection of the culture, was that they answered that they said they tuned in to understand their Bible better, to understand the Bible better, to know God better and love Him better, and how to love people better. And boy, is that a rejection of today's message.
Yeah, and that's really encouraging. And, you know, every day when I get responses and emails and social media comments from our listeners here at American Family Radio, those findings reflect what I hear just anecdotally as well from our listeners, that's exactly the reason that they tune into AFR is for encouragement and specifically for that perspective. And Trey Miller, you also described some of the findings as much, much higher than expected in terms of Christian media and this emphasis on, you know, how many people we're reaching overall in the culture. And so broadly, how does this shape where Christian media is going and kind of your vision of Christian media for the future, especially as, you know, we're in the midst of the congressional vote to cut federal funding for public broadcasters, which is a great position that taxpayer dollars shouldn't underwrite a media environment that's dominated just by a specific single political viewpoint. We should have access to Christian media as well, and the government shouldn't be funding a secular worldview. But then also the AM radio for every vehicle act and the government not determining who controls the flow of information within American vehicles. I mean, so there's a lot here, I think, as far as the future of Christian radio or Christian media, rather, but then also media more broadly in the legislative landscape.
Yes, exactly. You know, we're one of the initiators and supporters of the defunding of public radio and public television broadcasting, as well as the Corporation for Public Broadcasting that funds a lot of the programming, as you said, that really only, you know, serves as kind of a propaganda of the left progressive, you know, kind of woke messages out there. And tax dollars, you know, shouldn't be going to fund just one message like that. Plus, we in Christian media who fall under the same regulations of public interest programming have just never been on an equal footing with PBS, with all of the government support they have. It's not just in the funds, but as well as the legislation. So we applaud Congress for doing this. Our tax dollars shouldn't go for that. And look, I grew up on PBS. I'd love to see them go back to what their original core mission was, to do, you know, education and arts and entertainment that meet the needs of all of America, not just part of America or their senior management's viewpoints. And AM radio is a key one because that's so important. We believe that people should have free access to the information they want to hear, to the kind of programming they want to hear. We don't believe that there should be any gatekeepers, whether it's digitally on the internet or whether it's the airwaves in the car. And that's what the AM bill is really all about. It's about keeping access to free public over-the-air content for people to make their own choices. It's already been proven that the car companies can, you know, for very minimal, put some shielding in that doesn't cause any interference, and they can still have their connected dash, but people can have the choice of whether or not they want their subscriptions from the car company, or they just want to tune in their favorite Christian program or conservative talk program or sports program. And so we applaud Congress, and we're hoping that when they come out of their recess in August, that this bill is finally going to get passed and will clear the House to the president's desk.
Yeah, and I'm really thankful that the NRB is behind this, because I fully agree with that. I mean, just from my own perspective, I mean, a lot of the content that I've listened to over the years since the first time I had a car is just by tuning into a local radio station and, you know, finding that on, you know, AM or FM. And and this, of course, was before the days of streaming and, you know, some of the subscription services. And I think it is important and valuable that that Christian media organizations, like here at AFA, we have the streaming, the free app. You know, you can listen to this program. A lot of people, especially, you know, like my parents who are in Colorado, and so this is live from 6 to 7 a.m., which is a little bit early, you know, for them generally. So they tune in, you know, more at 8 a.m. their time, and they can do that on the streaming services, so you can kind of listen to it on demand. But for all of the terrestrial radio, it's so important that people just in their car can kind of flip through the stations and can hear content that they prefer, and that it's not just it's not cold and cultivated just by what the government would prefer that we listen to. That is so important that we have, you know, a wide variety of options. And so specifically with, you know, obviously there's a difference between AM and FM. Why is this specifically only talking about AM rather than, you know, any of the FM channels in terms of this particular legislation?
Well, I think the car companies looked at this as a sort of an easy target. I think they assumed that everybody thought AM radio was, you know, more antiquated and not listened to. But 84 million people, according to Inside Radio, still depend on AM radio. So I think this was a stepping stone for them. Had they accomplished this, to go from AM to FM would have been the next. And look, just a couple comments on what you said there. One, Christians communicators have been innovators for a long time. This is not about us trying to hold on to some legacy method of communication. As I said, 84 million people out there listen to AM radio, but Christian communicators have constantly been on that. Most radio stations are both over-the-air, terrestrial, and digital. But you used a key word in there, and the word was local. And the other thing that we're really looking into here is if you have this connected dash and everything is based on the, you know, internet, you're going to lose that localization. AM radio provides most of the local content across this country, local weather, local traffic, local news, community bulletin boards, and often, especially Christian AM radio stations, they're the first to be communicating in natural disaster. So, you know, as the floods or hurricanes or fires, people tune into their radios to find out, because cell service, internet service is often the first thing that goes. And we really think that that localization is very important to this country. It's very important to people in this country. And just to have these big, large national networks is really not serving the public interest and not meeting people's needs. Even though the car companies would like to become the next gatekeepers, we don't need another set of gatekeepers.
Yeah, that's really well said. And, you know, my colleague and our good friend, Abraham Hamilton III, always says on his program to live locally. And there is such an important value in local community, especially in the family and the church setting, but even in our specific local community and how we can minister. And, you know, when I moved to Florida, one of the first stations, because if I'm not listening to talk radio content and, you know, streaming some of these shows like Abe's, the Hamilton Corner that I listen to almost every day on demand, then, you know, sometimes I'll listen to music. And I found a local jazz station that I really like. And I've gotten to know kind of, you know, the DJs and some of those that occasionally, if I'm, you know, driving just for, you know, 10 minutes or so, I'll tune into on terrestrial radio. And it really is, with those perspectives, I've learned a lot about my local area that I live in just by listening to local radio. And that type of impact in Christian ministry, to be able to encourage people to live locally, not just have, you know, everything be so broad that people feel like they're just, you know, one in millions and millions of people, but really have a local impact, is so important. And I think that this also drives where Christian media can subsidize the church in terms of providing that type of hope and encouragement and, frankly, discipleship in a lot of ways as well, to supplement what should be the local church's efforts and community that the church provides to Christians as well in the community. So, Troy Miller, really appreciate it. And overall, you know, where is NRB headed with all of this? And, you know, just continuing to encourage the ministry of Christian media.
Yeah, and look, Jenna, thank you for having me on today. And look, we see a bright future for Christian media. Again, I see a lot of Christian ministries that are doing some great innovation. I see some young people in the Gen Zers who are doing some really neat things on these social media platforms out there. And look, we see the numbers tell us that this is growing, and we have a mission and we have a purpose. So we're continuing to work and help ministries understand the latest technologies, the latest methods, the latest tools that are out there. And then, of course, we're working in D.C. Very hard to keep the legislative, business environment, regulatory environment as fair as possible as it can be for Christian communicators out there. There's still a lot of opposition to our message. Corporate America now is our big target because that's where we're seeing most of the opposition. So we're working hard. We're going to get this study out to all of the C-suites in the Fortune 500 companies so they can understand how large this audience is. And we appreciate you, appreciate your prayers and all the work that we're doing.
Thanks so much. Well, Troy Miller of the National Religious Broadcasters Association, really appreciate your time and the ministry that you do and the work that you do. And, you know, I just want to say to listeners as well, I mean, this is exactly why I love being part of the AFR family. I love, as regular listeners know, the medium of radio. This is my favorite media because it's long form content. We can get into the conversations. We can talk about things. It's not, you know, focusing on all the visuals and the, you know, the bright, shiny lights of television. I've done that for a long time. But, you know, radio, you just focus on the content. And this is such an important ministry. And I'm so grateful to be here. And even though, you know, I've had even within the last few weeks, you know, opportunities to go back into politics or, you know, other things that are great, great, you know, jobs, great, you know, places and all of that. I've chosen to stay here because I really believe in our ministry and the work that we do here. So we'll be right back with more.
Together, you and I have much to celebrate. Last year, because of your caring help, Preborn rescued over 67,000 babies from abortion. Hi, I'm Dan Steiner, president of Preborn, and I want to thank you for your partnership. Think about what you did. 67,000 little babies are taking their first breath now because of your caring help. Your $28 sponsored one ultrasound that was given to one woman as she was deciding about the future of her baby. Once she saw her precious baby for the first time and heard their sweet baby's heartbeat, the chance of that child living doubled. And Preborn's mission is not only to rescue babies' lives, but also to lead women to Jesus Christ. Last year, we saw 8,900 women receive Christ as Savior. Your help is crucial to continue our life-saving work.
Your caring, tax-deductible gift saves lives. To learn more or donate, visit preborn.com/AFR or dial #250 and say the keyword baby.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. So not only is it a privilege and a ministry to bring the news of the day from a biblical worldview perspective, not just a, you know, Republican versus Democrat and, you know, within all of the specific politicking of the day, but we also talk about the other institutions that God ordained. Of course, there are three: the civil government, the church government, and the family government, and encouragement within all of those spheres. Because if we are to, as Christians, live our lives according to the commands of Scripture and what God provides clearly as the best way for us to thrive and to also fulfill our purpose, which is, of course, to first know and love Him, and then to bring others along in the knowledge of Christ. That also includes raising children in the fear and admonition of the Lord. And of course, that touches the political sphere when we have to debate and discuss these issues of how government interacts with parenting, what all of that means and parental rights. That's a huge, huge topic because children, of course, are given to parents by God, not to the state. Children don't belong to the state, and we need to make sure that those lines are very clearly protected in an increasingly secularized culture where the government has not only tried to make the church completely irrelevant, but basically replace parents. And often we are taught in today's secularized society that parents, if they're not experts, quote unquote, whatever that means to the state, that, you know, if you don't have your doctorate in all of these different subject matter areas that you are teaching your children, well, then you're not fully competent to teach your children. And we need to take them not only to the quote unquote experts in the state run school system, but we also need to take them to these experts that are called therapists. And really what that's doing is setting up not only children to not trust their parents and kind of undermine that parental authority that really should be centered on discipleship, but also trust whatever the state labels and their metric and society labels as expertise. It should be that parents understand that children are vested by God to them to train up in the way they should go, as Proverbs said, so when they're older, they won't depart from it. And that kind of discipleship can only come from parents and, of course, from the church, which should also encourage and supplement the parental responsibility and role. We know that the nuclear family, one husband, one wife, one mother, one father, in the context of the traditional nuclear family is the best environment for children to thrive, to understand who they are as human beings made in the image of God, having inherent dignity and worth, know their purpose, be able to ask and answer and have answered their questions about life, about their own vocation and ministry as they get older. For regular listeners, you know, you all know that I, at a very young age, I'm being homeschooled, discipled by my parents, greatest gift that my parents blessed me with. I knew from age 14 I wanted to become a lawyer. And, you know, could I have ever imagined what God would do in my life in ministry? Well, you know, He's had a wonderful story unfolding in my life. And I love now using all of those skill sets that my parents developed in me early in the discipleship frankly, to then lead to the ministry that I'm doing today and what I'll continue to do for the rest of my life. And so, you know, there was a an Instagram post that I want to play for you because this was just really encouraging to me. This was from actually a renowned clinical psychologist, Dr. Donald Wincott, who was talking about parenting advice, that so much of this is, as he calls it, biologically determined, but really this is about, you know, God creating each individual child and how we are, as parents, the shepherds of children in that sense, to bring them, of course, along to getting to know and love, ultimately, the good shepherd. And so I want to play this clip for you because this advice, I think, was just really encouraging. This is cut two.
You need to understand something the parents these days have long since forgot, and they're going to have to relearn again. Your grandparents knew this, but today's generation of parents doesn't seem to. And that is, you do not get to design your children. Nature would never have permitted that to happen. Evolution would not have allowed a generation of a species to be so influenced by the previous generation. It hasn't happened, and it doesn't happen, and it especially doesn't happen in children. You do not design your children. And yet we have the Mozart effect, the belief that if I play classical music to my uterus when I'm pregnant, I'm going to have a genius. The fact that if I can just put enough crib toys over his crib, he is going to have all these neurons exploding with synapses and be a brilliant mathematician. You don't get that degree of power. Does that mean stimulation doesn't matter? No, it means a stimulation environment is better than a deprived environment. But it doesn't mean that the more stimulation you add into the environment, the better it gets. It's a threshold. There is enough stimulation that every normal brain needs to develop. And once you're past that, which 98% of you are, the rest of it is out of your hands. So what we have learned in the last 20 years of research in neuroimaging, behavior genetics, developmental psychology, neuropsychology can be boiled down to this phrase. Your child is born with more than 400 psychological traits that will emerge as they mature, and they have nothing to do with you. So the idea that you are going to engineer personalities and IQ and academic achievement skills and all these other things just isn't true. Your child is not a blank slate on which you get to write. Your child is a genetic mosaic of your extended family, which means this is a unique combination of the traits that run in your family line. I like the shepherd view. You are a shepherd. You don't design the sheep. The engineering view makes you responsible for everything. Everything that goes right and everything that goes wrong. This is why parents come to us with such guilt, more guilt than we've ever seen in prior generations, because parents today believe that it's all about them and what they do. And if they don't get it right, or if their child has a disability, they've done something wrong, when in fact the opposite is true. This has nothing to do with your particular brand of parenting. So I would rather that you stop thinking yourself as an engineer and step back and say, I am a shepherd to a unique individual. Shepherds are powerful people. They pick the pastures in which the sheep will graze and develop and grow. They determine whether they're appropriately nourished. They determine whether they're protected from harm. The environment is important, but it doesn't design the sheep. No shepherd is going to turn a sheep into a dog. Ain't going to happen, right? And yet that is what we see parents trying to do all the time, and especially parents of children with disabilities. So step back and view yourself as the shepherd to this disabled youngster, and you get to design the pasture. And that's very important, but you don't engineer the sheep. Now, that comes with it a profoundly freeing view of parenting, because what it means is, although it's important to be a shepherd, recognizing that this is a unique individual before you allows you to enjoy the show, right? So open a bottle of Chardonnay, kick off your slippers, sit back and watch what takes place, because you don't get to determine this, right? So enjoy it. It doesn't last all that long anyway. They're gone before you know it, right? But if you think that what you did in your house is going to shape the life course of this individual, you are sadly mistaken. Right? This is a unique individual. Let them grow. Let them prosper. Please design appropriate environments around them. But you don't get to design them.
I loved this clip, and I love the way that the psychologist talks about the difference between engineering, which of course is God, our creator, who wired us uniquely as individuals, versus the shepherding, which is the discipleship. And this guy, I don't know if he's a Christian, based on you know, what he said. I can't determine that. He didn't obviously implicate any deference to God being the engineer, but he actually gets it right here, maybe accidentally, by recognizing just the truth of the reality to which we're presented, that it is God who uniquely creates every individual human being, and parents are the shepherds for their children. And, you know, as Proverbs 22:6 says, as I've mentioned in this segment, and I mentioned quite frequently, it says, train up a child in the way he should go. Even when he is old, he will not depart from it. And that type of discipline, love, legacy, instruction, that's what parents can do and the greatest gift that they can give to their children, like what my parents gave to me. And, you know, God gave me specific gifts, talents, personalities, made me a very unique human being that was not at all engineered by my parents, but they took that and simply shaped and molded it. So I hope that for parents listening, grandparents listening, that you're encouraged by that, because we can absolutely disciple children, and that's what's best for the next generation. So as always, you can reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
Preborn's whole mission is to rescue babies from abortion and lead their families to Christ. Last year, Preborn's network of clinics saw 8,900 mothers come to Christ. Please join us in this life-saving mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.